part six of Christ Line. Tonight we're going to talk about Jacob and pilgrimage. And by way of introduction, I've got a set of scriptures for you, punchy scriptures. And I just want to read these to you, and I'm sure you will see a common thread running through them. John 11:22, I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Matthew 24, verse 32, now learn this lesson. Luke 11, verse 31, now one greater than Solomon is here. Luke 11, 32, now one greater than Jonah is here. John 9, 25, I was blind, but now I see. John 16, verse 11, the prince of this world now stands condemned. Romans 5, verse 2, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. Romans 5 verse 9, since we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? Romans 5 11, we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation. Romans 8 verse 1, therefore there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. 2 Corinthians 6 2, now is the time of God's favour, now is the day of salvation. 2 Corinthians 13 7, now we pray to God. Galatians 3:25. Now that faith has come. Ephesians 5:8. Now you are light in the Lord. Colossians 1:24. Now I rejoice. Hebrews 11:1. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Hebrews 12:26. Now he has promised. 1 John 3:2. Now we are the children of God. Now did you notice any common thread in those verses? Yes, that's right, they're all in the Bible. Now is the common thing. And I believe in a now God. I believe that God is with me now. He is alive in me now. He is speaking to me now. He is blessing me now. He is working for my good now. But he isn't like instant coffee. When I was a kid, I used to read all these American comic books. Superman, you know, Batman, and the X-Men, and all these type of things. And there was always a page in every one that had all these, like, novelties you could send off and buy. Of course, I could never buy them because they were all priced in dollars, and that you had to send to America. You know, when I was a boy, of course, you had to can only get to America when the camels were going that direction. It's not like it is now. And I desperately wanted the expanding pet. You could buy this expanding pet, and you just dropped it in water and expanded and became something that wobbled around in the water. And I think they wanted you to think it was alive. Funnily enough, much later in life, when I actually did get one of these, I then found that it was a piece of rubbish, as indeed I'm sure most of these adverts were. But God is not like one of these little animal things that you buy out of the packet, open it and drop it into water and it expands suddenly and comes to life. God is not an instant God. He is a now God. But you see, our problem with talking about a God of the now is that we equate that to a God of the instant, when actually God is with us now and he wants to walk with us now. But that doesn't necessarily mean we get instant response to, or what we call instant, always, all of the time. Now, let me explain that by talking about the life of Jacob. Because Jacob understood something which we really need to learn. And that is that God may well be the God of the moment, but those moments build up into months and years, and that actually God is the God who walks with us if we will walk with him. And that is what pilgrimage is all about. So as much as nobody isn't going to tell me that God isn't a God of the now, God is a God of the now, God is here now, but what he is working in us and through us can take a lifetime, and that lifetime we call our pilgrimage. Genesis 47 verse 9. Jacob says these words. to Pharaoh, "The years of my pilgrimage are 130. My years have been few and difficult, and they do not equal the years of the pilgrimage of my fathers." In fact, if you read on a few verses, it says, "Now Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, and his lifespan was 147 years. Walking with God is just that. It's a walk. It's a pilgrimage. It's a job in formation. It's a work in action. It's not something that all happens instantly. How I wish the day I had committed my life to Jesus that Christ had been fully formed in me and I had never sinned since. That would be very nice. But the fact is, we are a work in progress. And that progress, which there should be progress, is the manifestation of pilgrimage in the life and heart of the believer. Working with us and around us may take God a minute. It might take him an hour. It might take him a month or a year, a decade, or a generation. But if we cooperate with God, our pilgrimage will be great. And it can be something that books are written about. That's what happened with Jacob. So, what is this pilgrimage? Well, pilgrimage, the word that's used for pilgrimage in this verse in Genesis 47, verse 9, is a word that means a sojourning place, a dwelling place. Really, what it is, it means a temporary residence that is nomadic in state. So we're talking about a tent that gets moved along from place to place. And the life in that tent is what is described as the pilgrimage. Right? So that's what pilgrimage is. Now, to understand pilgrimage in the context of Jacob's life, we need to understand Jacob. And I'm a name person. Names are very important to me. What I've named my children has been important to me. And I thank God that my parents gave me a good name. Names, I believe, can be a great blessing, particularly as you shout them as your kids all the time. And so shouting a good name is not a bad thing. Now, Jacob didn't have a brilliant name. And I want us to start by examining Jacob the heel. You know the name, the word heel? Americanism, it's maybe getting a bit dated now, but it means a dishonorable man or a cad when they say, oh, he's a heel. A dishonorable person, a cad. Well, that's pretty close, actually, to A, what Jacob was, and B, what his name meant. Last week we were talking about Abraham. Abraham had the child of the promise with Sarah, Isaac. Isaac means laughter. That's a nice name. And Isaac married Rebekah, and they had twin boys. And in Genesis 25, we read how Jacob came into the world. And this is very relevant to the rest of his life. Genesis 25:21. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife, because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man, a computer programmer, staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau. But Rebekah, who loved Space Invaders, loved Jacob. I'm sorry, but I do tend to think of that. You know, I think I always remember, I never grew up to be a man of the open country. I was the one who stayed in the tent, so there we go. Jacob came out holding Esau's heel, grasping his heel. Now, you've got to understand that to a man of that generation, that meant something. To grasp the heel, or to supplant, is the same word as the name Jacob. And he was named Jacob because that was what he was doing when he was born. I suppose this is a bit like those stories of the Red Indians, you know, where the baby's born and they call him Running Man, because the first thing that the squaw saw when she looked out the teepee was a man running, you know, or he was named, you know, Limping Goat or something, because it was a limping goat. That's the sort of way the Red Indians used to name their kids, isn't it? And I suppose it's a little bit like that. We don't really think like that these days, but that was the way that they thought. And Jacob was called heel holder or heel grabber, which is the same set of words as Jacob. Jacob, it's the same phrase. It means to grab the heel. But to grab the heel means to supplant or to trick. And if you think about it, that even makes sense in our modern thinking. Because if you're walking along, and I'm sort of hidden under a rug there, you know, because I would obviously hide very easily under a rug, and I just reached out my hand and grabbed your heel as you went past, you would be tripped up, wouldn't you? It's a surefire way of tripping someone up, is to grab their heel while they're trying to walk. So if you trip someone up, you can then take their position. And that is exactly what Jacob means. It means to grab someone's heel, you trip them up, you take their position. If you like, you take over from where they were. And so Jacob was called this name. And I ask myself, when I read things like this, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Did Jacob become a person who tricked and supplanted and grasped the heel? Did he become that because all the time he was called, "You heel grasper. Come here, heel grasper. Heel grasper, come in for your tea." Did he become that person because he was called it all the time? Or was there some great prophetic insight going on when he was born, so much so that because they saw what he was doing, they knew what he would become? Well, I'm not sure about the answer to that. I think there might be a bit of both going on. But I certainly think if you have a child and you call them heel grasper all their lives, they'll probably grasp the heel. I think that makes sense. And I think it's true to say, I remember counselling a lady some years ago who, from being a child, her dad had called her ugly. And he would say, "Ugly, come here. Ugly, get your mother a cup of tea." And she had a huge complex about the way she looked, because she'd been told all her life she was ugly. And this is only the same thing. I'm not stretching a point here. You know, when you're calling a man heel grasper, well, you know, it's a little bit like me saying to you, "You criminal, you. You burglar, you burglar, you burglar." And you go out and think, well, everybody calls me a burglar, everybody thinks I'm a burglar, I may as well burgle. So just maybe there's something going on like that here with Jacob. What is really the sad thing is that the whole of Jacob's life can be summed up by his name. Only when he was much older and he overcame his own nature did the Lord change his name in recognition of the change of heart. So we're going to go on a journey now with Jacob on his pilgrimage and see how he moved from being heel grasper to having a new name. Right, so you've heard the word sting, haven't you? You hear about it mainly now on the news when they're talking about the police set up a sting to catch criminals or something, but I suppose it became popular with the old Robert Redford movie. A sting's a complicated confidence game, planned and executed with great care. That's the dictionary definition of sting. And Jacob performed a couple of stings. And the first one was the birthright sting. Now, we also need to understand something else about Jacob and Esau, and that is this. In those days, there was such a thing as the birthright. The firstborn son in any family got an extra portion upon the death of the father. That means this. If you had two children, as Jacob did, then the estate was divided into three parts. And the firstborn got two parts. If there were five children, the estate was split into six, and the firstborn got two parts. So being the firstborn gave you a real advantage. And there was a terrific difference in your inheritance. And particularly with Jacob and Esau, you know, talking of 2-1. A very distinct difference in inheritance. So, Jacob, I would suggest to you, was clearly eaten up by the fact that he was born a minute later, or however long it was, than his brother Esau. Because by the advantage of being born a minute sooner, if it had only been 10 seconds sooner, Esau was entitled to an extra portion of inheritance. I can imagine Jacob going around muttering under his breath, only a minute later, for 1 minute, my brother gets a bigger portion than I do. It's not right, I tell you. It's not right. We're twins. We should split it down the middle. And maybe that ate away at him. I've certainly met a lot of people who've had things eat away at them that were worse, that were less important than that. You can more or less see Jacob's point, can't you? But it was the way it was done. Now, we read in Genesis 25 that when the boys grow up, it says this in verse 29, Jacob was cooking some stew. Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished. Jacob replied, first, sell me your birthright. Now, there's a bit of lack of brotherly love there, isn't there? You know, oh, famished, I'm famished. Oh, are you? All right, give me something for it then, and I'll give you food. And it wasn't just give me something. It's give me the thing that you've got that you are the only one who can ever have, and I missed it by a minute. Give that to me. I want your birthright. Now, was Jacob right to do this? Well, I don't think so. I really don't think so. Particularly when you read, as we did read, that prophetically Rebekah was told that the older son would serve the younger. So prophetically it was known that the day that would come when Jacob would actually be the senior son. So if that was the case, there was no need to engineer a set of circumstances that would alter the pecking order. The second sad thing about this, really, is Esau's attitude. Esau says, look, I'm about to die. I don't really think he was, actually. I don't think he was. I think he was just famished. He'd had a good day hunting, he was hungry, and he said he was about to die. So he said, what good is the birthright to me? Sometimes we get things out of perspective, don't we? We've been out all day, we missed our sandwich at lunch, and we never miss our sandwich at lunch, and it's tea time and we're famished and we think we're going to drop dead out of starvation. Let's be honest about it, that's totally out of proportion, isn't it? It's totally out of proportion, particularly if you want to go and watch some newsreel about parts of Africa right now. It's totally out of proportion, yet we do react like that to things. And if you actually believe you're going to die, then a birthright's no good to you. Esau believed a load of rubbish. And Jacob says to him, swear to me first. So Esau swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and stew. And it says, so Esau despised his birthright. Now, this is the great indicator of what was going on here. Jacob wanted something that wasn't his, and Esau didn't want what he had. Jacob lusted and coveted after something that was not his, and Esau, that had the blessing of it, did not appreciate what a blessing it was. Sad, isn't it? And I'll leave you to think about that, because we can all put ourselves in one or two of those places. We've probably been on both sides of it over different issues in our lives. So what Jacob valued, Esau placed no value on. And Jacob did him. He grasped Esau's heel, and Esau stumbled. It's not, you know, just a matter of tricking somebody that Jacob did. But when you actually make someone stumble, you are doubly guilty, aren't you? It's not that you've taken something that wasn't really yours. It's not just that. But you actually make the other person stumble. It's a terrible, terrible thing to do. Then there was the blessing sting. Now, you see, not only is there a birthright for the firstborn, but the firstborn gets a special blessing from the father before the father dies. And in Genesis 27, it says, when Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak that he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his older son, and said to him, I am now an old man and don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your weapons, your quiver and bow, and go out to the open country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like, and bring it to me to eat, so I may give you my blessing before I die. Now Rebekah was listening. And Rebekah said to her son Jacob, I overheard your father say to your brother Esau, bring me some game and prepare me some tasty food to eat, so that I may give you my blessing in the presence of the Lord before I die. Now, my son, listen carefully and do what I tell you. Go out into the flock and bring me two choice young goats, so I can prepare some tasty food for your father, just the way he likes it. Then take it to your father to eat, so that he may give you his blessing before he dies. Jacob said to his mother, but my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I'm a man with smooth skin. What if my father touches me? I would appear to be tricking him and would bring down a curse on myself rather than a blessing. At this point, you know that Jacob has already thought, hang on here, this is a good idea, I'm going to go along with my mother. Oh, I've just thought of a problem. And his mother says to him, my son, let the curse fall on me. Just do as I say. So she dresses Jacob up in Esau's best clothes that smell of sweat in the country, and she makes some tasty food out of these goats, and Jacob goes into his father. And Jacob said to his father, I am Esau. I have done as you told me. Please sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing. Isaac asked his son, how did you find it so quickly? The Lord, your God, gave me success, he replied. What a terrible lie to tell, even invoking the name of the Lord in your lie. That's awful, isn't it? Then Isaac said to Jacob, come near so I can touch you, my son, to know whether you really are my son or not. Jacob went close to his father Isaac, who touched him and said, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. He did not recognize him, for his hands were hairy like his brother Esau. So he blessed him. Are you really my son, Esau? He asked. I am, Jacob replied. So he had his meal, thought it was fabulous, and then he blessed Jacob. He said, may God give you of heaven's dew and of earth's richness, an abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed, and those who bless you be blessed. You may think you've heard that blessing before, and you would be right, because it's very, very, very similar to the blessing that God gave to Abraham. God gave that blessing to Abraham. Abraham passed that to Isaac, and Isaac was now passing that to whom he thought was his firstborn son. Was in fact passing that to Jacob. And Jacob goes away having stolen the blessing, and Esau comes back having prepared the game, takes it into his dad, And his dad starts to shake with rage. What has happened here? And then the whole family know. And Isaac says to Esau, "Your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing." And Esau said, "Isn't he rightly named Jacob? He has deceived me these two times. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." And then, of course, Esau goes on to threaten Jacob's life, which some people would say, I'm not surprised either. But what happened here? Jacob grasped Esau's heel, and Esau stumbled. Esau was brought into a place where there was an invitation for Esau to sin. Esau was brought down into a place where he could claim all types of issue with his brother Jacob. And all that had happened was Jacob and his mother had engineered a plot that brought about what prophecy had already said would come to him anyway. You know, we don't have to engineer the fulfillment of prophecy. What we have to do is have a humble heart and wait on God, and God will bring it to pass. So, were either of these stings that Jacob pulled off the right way to get blessing or birthright? Answer, no. There was no wisdom involved in this, just cunning, subterfuge, and the grasping of the heel. One verse that is one of the most important verses in the Bible to me, Romans 8:28, says this: "And we know that in all things God is working for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." Where does that fit into Jacob's life? Where does that fit in? You see, if God is working for our good, we don't need to. I'm going to say that again because it's very important. If God is working for our good, we don't need to work for our good. We need to work for his good. His kingdom come. Then he will work for us. Matthew 6:33, "But seek, aim at, and strive after, first of all, his kingdom and his righteousness, his way of doing and being right. Then all these things taken together will be given to you besides." That's the Amplified version. And very, very telling in this situation. So we've got a man, he's been called heel grasper, and all he's done so far with his life is grasp people's heels, trip them up, and get his own way by being the Dick Dastardly of his generation. Instead of winning the race by fair means, he's won by foul. So, Jacob then has a meeting with God. Now, what happens is that after all of this has blown up, Isaac actually sends Jacob away to Uncle Laban to go and get married over there and be there for a while, where he's going to be safe. And Isaac actually gives him, formally, knowing who it is, the blessing of Abraham. And when you think that maybe a matter of hours passed between these two events, I have to ask, if Jacob had never tricked Esau and tricked his father, would he not have also received this blessing when he was going to Laban anyway? And it's a sad thing that he got the blessing by subterfuge, and a few hours later he gets the thing genuinely from his father. So he moves on, and in fact, Isaac's exact words, Isaac, is, "May God give you and your offspring the blessing of Abraham." So it's clear, isn't it? So in Genesis 28, it says, "Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. When he reached a certain place, he stopped for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones there, he put it under his head and lay down to sleep. He had a dream in which he saw a stairway resting on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. There above it stood the Lord, and he said, 'I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and the east, to the north and the south. all peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. Those are the exact words of the promise to Abraham. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. All of that came from God at the time that Jacob was in the right place. It didn't need subterfuge and heel grasping. Jacob had that coming to him anyway, but because he didn't believe it would work out in his favour, Jacob tried to force it. And you know, that is actually why we do things very often that we shouldn't do. It's because we don't actually believe in the goodness of the Lord. We don't actually believe that God will look after us. We borrow lots of money because we don't actually believe that God is our source. I know that's true. We do lots of things because we don't actually believe God will look after us. And we need to. Because we know that in all things God is working for the good of those that love him, who are called according to his purpose. And you might say, well, I'm not sure if I'm called. Of course you are. He called you. He called you by name. He called you by name to turn your back on your sin and walk towards him and walk with him. He called you into pilgrimage. And in the context of your pilgrimage, you will always see how God was good. You just have to learn patience and persistence until you receive it. Yes? So, Jacob had his meeting with God. It might be reasonable, I think, to assume that this was Jacob's epiphany, the moment in which he had a real revelation of God. And from that moment, Jacob walked a different walk. Jacob's had a couple of stings that he's perpetrated on his brother. The next big event in Jacob's life is someone perpetrates a sting on him. Genesis 29. He gets to visit his uncle Laban, and when he sees Rachel, the daughter of Laban, he went over and rolled a stone away and watered his uncle's sheep. He kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. And it says, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel, and said to Laban, I'll work with you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. Laban said, well, it's better I give her to you than some other man. Stay here with me. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife. My time is completed. I want to lie with her. Straightforward and to the point. So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob. And Jacob lay with her. The lighting obviously wasn't very good in those days. And Laban gave his daughter Zilpah to his daughter as her maidservant. When morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? Laban said, oh, it's not our custom to give the youngest daughter first, and blah, blah, blah. Finish out this daughter's bridal week, and then you can serve me another 7 years for the other one. So Laban grasped Jacob's heel, and Jacob stumbled. He's so convinced he loves this woman, he's prepared to pay with 7 years of his life. But it actually costs him double the price. He's done. A confidence trick. Sounds familiar, eh? I wonder why. God is not mocked. A man will reap what he sows. And it may well be that at Bethel, where, with his head on a stone, Jacob had an epiphany and met God. And it may well be that at that moment in time, Jacob started a pilgrimage in a real way with God. But Jacob had been sowing for years, and a crop was on the way. Jacob that little heel grabber had his own heel grabbed. Now, was Laban right to do that? Did Jacob deserve it? You can ask all these questions if you want, but the real point is this. He got a taste of his own medicine. Was it God trying to slap him round the face and teach him a lesson? No, I think it was just simply this. A man reaps what he sows. There's some sort of law built into the universe that a man reaps what he sows. And that's what happened with Jacob. So, sometimes we need to understand that pushing our own agenda and operating out of the wrong heart doubles the costs in our life. You know, the Bible says before you build anything, you should decide whether you can afford it. You don't want to run out of bricks halfway because you couldn't afford the next delivery from B&Q. And that's true. We have to consider the cost. But the problem is, if we're used to charging double to people, then people might charge double to us. And we need to watch that. We need to be careful how we are sowing. How about the mandrake sting? Jacob gets married to these women. They start having babies. And Leah gives him 4 children to start with in rapid fire. And in Genesis chapter 30, during the wheat harvest, Reuben, who's Jacob's oldest son, went out into the fields and found some mandrake plants. And he took them to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes. They look really nice on the mantelpiece, next to the picture of my dad." Something like that. And she said to her, "Wasn't it enough that you took away my husband?" Oh, there's a whole thing going on here between them, isn't there? Leah knows that Jacob doesn't love her, really. And Jacob loves Rachel. And so Leah wants to withhold these flowers. So what Rachel does is, she says to Leah, "Look, I'll tell you what. Give me some of your son's mandrakes, and you can sleep with Jacob tonight in return." So when Jacob came in from the fields that evening, Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must sleep with me. I have hired you with my son's mandrakes." If you like, Jacob became a male prostitute. He was hired for the night by a bunch of flowers, which is pretty cheap going, but probably a better price than I could fetch. So, here's the point, and that is this. Jacob was Rebekah's favourite. Jacob was his mother's favourite. And Rachel was Jacob's favourite. But God does not exhibit favouritism. The Bible is very clear. God does not exhibit favouritism. The Christ line came through Leah. The Christ line came through Leah, not through Rachel. Rachel, at one point, stole her father's household gods. Rachel lied to her father that she hadn't stolen them. Rachel was bitter about not conceiving. And she had lots of issues in her life. And in fact, she died in childbirth the second time when she gave birth to Benjamin. Interesting sting there. Jacob gets done again. Well, if that wasn't enough, we then read in Genesis 30 where Jacob fleeces Laban's flocks. Now, this is a little bit of a different story. The fact is, at this point in his life, Jacob has had his wages changed a few times. Let's face it, he's worked 14 years for Laban, for his daughters. And Laban is a bit worried about Jacob because Jacob keeps prospering. Of course, Jacob will prosper because God has promised him that he will. Is there anybody in the room that God's promised to them that they will prosper? Answer, if you're a Christian, yes. God has promised that he will prosper you. And Laban gets a bit worried about this. And so the long and short story of it is this. He says, "Look, I don't know whose sheep are whose. All these sheep look alike to me. For all I know, you're ripping me off. So here's the rule. You can have the spotted sheep, of which there are about 3, and I'll have the plain sheep, of which there are about 9 million, right? Laban's been very fair with this, and Jacob's got nothing. Well, this is what happens. Jacob took fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees and made white stripes on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood. When the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. In other words, Laban's sheep gave birth to Jacob's sheep. So Jacob fleeced him of his flocks. And after a generation of sheep had gone through, Jacob had got 9 million sheep and Laban had got 3, or something like that. And what's more is Jacob only put out these speckled and striped pieces of wood in the feeding troughs when the strong sheep were there. The weak ones, the ones that looked a bit doddery and a bit lame, he didn't put them out for them. So the strong ones bred for Jacob. Now then, two things about this. Was this wrong of Jacob? Up to now, what we've seen is Jacob grasping the heel. But was this the wrong thing? It was cunning. I'll give him that, it was cunning. But actually, was Jacob really cheating his uncle out of his flocks? Well, I'm going to say no to that, because I'll tell you what was happening here. Jacob was walking the walk of faith. The Bible talks about walking from faith to faith. And Jacob was walking from faith to faith in this. I once heard a man give a lecture on how the visual stimulus of the striped bits of wood caused a genetic change in the womb of these sheep, and they gave birth to speckled sheep. I always thought it was a load of rubbish, but he missed the point. The point isn't that the sheep saw these bits of wood. The point is that Jacob saw them. These sheep were coming there to mate while they were drinking. And when Jacob put out the speckled signs, it was an aid to Jacob's faith. He was lifting up a sign. It might as well have been a big sign painted on the barn saying, "My God will prosper me." Because he believed that what was going to happen was if he put those stripy sticks out, he would get stripy sheep. And it was Jacob's faith that caused the sheep to be born that way. It wasn't anything to do with visual stimulus to a bunch of goats. What a crazy idea. How some people think you can explain stuff, I don't know. This was an act of faith. And Jacob was acting in faith. He was acting shrewdly. But remember, Jesus blessed the shrewd manager. But what Jacob was doing was, for once, he was learning that he could get there by faith without having to use underhand tactics. And we need to learn that task. And that is part of pilgrimage. Learning that is part of pilgrimage. You see, when Jacob and Laban eventually had a head-to-head, Jacob says to him, the heat consumed me daytime, it was cold at night, sleep fled from my eyes. It was like this for the 20 years I was in your household. I worked for you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wages 10 times. Now, I don't think inflation was very high in those days, and they didn't have to have this inflationary wage rise, you know? And where you go in and you get some points as well for how good you've been in your job, and if you get a few more points, you move up a grade and you get a little bit more. It wasn't like that in those days. They didn't need pay rises. They just needed their pay. And what Jacob did was he got 10 adjustments to his pay. And believe me, Laban intended them all to go down, but God intended them all to go up. And that's in fact what happened, because Jacob became a very wealthy man. Having learnt in his pilgrimage this one thing, that if he can believe that the promise of God to prosper him, that he will prosper, Jacob moves on. And at this time, he's left Laban, he's taking his wife and family back to the old homestead, and he knows he's going to meet Esau. And he's not particularly excited about this, because the last thing he heard from Esau was, I'm going to get you. So he's not that sort of excited about meeting Esau. But in Genesis chapter 32, verse 24, we start to read a very significant portion of Jacob's life. And I would suggest to you this is probably the most significant thing that happened to him. So Jacob was left alone. This is verse 24 of chapter 32. And a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. The man asked him, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome. Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he replied, why do you ask my name? Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, it is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. I think it's a sad reflection that with all the significance in this chapter, the memory that the Jews have it today is not to eat a certain bit of meat. I think that's missing the point. The point is here. Jacob, heel grabber. Heel grabber wrestles with a man. Who is the man? Well, Jacob says, what is your name? And the man says, why do you ask my name? And Jacob calls the place Peniel, saying, it is because I saw God. The man was a theophany. It was a God in the form of a man. It was God come down in a man's body to commune with Jacob. But this was a very odd communion. It was a wrestling match. Jacob wrestled this man. Now, what's this all about? Now, we started off this series by talking about authority. And we've referred to authority in different weeks. And the question I would have for you right now is, of all the people on the earth at this time, who had authority? The answer is Jacob. Because God had given it to him. He'd had a meeting with God, and God had given him the authority and blessing he'd given to Abraham. Jacob was God's man on the earth at that time. Jacob was the man that God had charged with working out his kingdom. And he was the man that God had put in a position of authority. He had promised him the whole land to rule over. So, this is the man who is in charge of the realm, and God comes to wrestle him. Now, I've heard people say, oh, well, a man could never wrestle God and win. Well, who does the earth belong to? Who's been given authority in the situation? Let me tell you something. Jacob is just the man who could wrestle God, because he was a man of authority. But the Jacob of chapter 27 could never have won the battle or won the wrestling match with God, because he would have used subterfuge, and his character was not formed into that which would persist. You see, Jacob was not going to let go. It didn't matter what was happening in this wrestling match. Jacob wasn't going to let go. If you struggle to believe that a man can overcome God in a wrestling match, then you tell me that it's any different when God is after your heart and your heart, and for years you resist him. Who wins the wrestling match? There are plenty of people who go to their graves and have never God has never overcome them in that wrestling match because they have had authority of their own lives. They have had the choice, the free will that God has given them. And God has never imposed himself on that wrestling match. He has just made himself in their face time after time after time so that they could choose him. And yet they have not done that. So, the pilgrimage that Jacob had formed him into a person that would persist. In fact, God had to put his hip out of joint to even have a chance of terminating this wrestling match. And the pilgrimage that Jacob had that night with God needed as much persistence as the whole of his life had needed. And indeed, his persistence was what he showed that night. Jacob continued the fight in extreme pain and personal discomfort because he realized that the real blessing was not one that he could trick from God, but one he had to wrestle for. To give himself whatever the cost so that God would bless him. Jacob did not grasp at God's heel, but instead demonstrated persistence and determination, overcoming his own character flaws to become a new man in God. And that is the wrestling match. It's the pilgrimage that God is calling all of us to overcome the flaws that we have and to absolutely allow God to make us into a new man. After Jacob realized the truth of Romans 8:28, and you say, well, Romans 8:28 was written after Jacob. Yeah, but it was still true even before it was written. Jacob realized it because in Genesis 35 verse 3, he says this: he has been with me everywhere I have gone. Talking of God. Jacob said, God has been with me everywhere I have gone. You see, with the benefit of this wonderful gift called hindsight, Jacob was able to look back and say, throughout my pilgrimage, God has been with me. I can see God has been working for my good. I screwed up big style. Oh, I got it into my head. If I just did this, I could sort it all out. In fact, my mother egged me on. And let's face it, everybody always said I was a heel grasper. And I figured if I did this, I could sort it. I can sort it. I can make this happen. I can adjust this. I can be a manipulator. My mother was. So can I be. He figured this. But he said, now I look back, I realize that God was with me. And God was working for my good. And I didn't need to do all this stupid stuff. And when he fought, when wrestled with God, God changed his name to Israel. And when in chapter 35, when Jacob says, he has been with me everywhere I have gone, at that moment of realization and revelation, at that moment, God speaks and confirms his name change and says, you will be called Israel, which means he prevails with God, or he is a prince with God. Prince with God, or prevails with God. And you understand why, in the context of the wrestling match, that God was able to change his name. When God changed his name, he was confirming that there had been a change of nature. When they called him that heel grasper, that was the only witness they had of his nature. He was born, that's what he was doing, that was the only example they had of his nature. They called him heel grasper. When he wrestled God, God saw a man of persistence who was prepared to walk the pilgrimage, a man who would not let go of the blessing. And God named him accordingly. So Jacob's pilgrimage continues. There is much we could say of when he met Esau. We could talk about when Rachel died, a terrible time. We could talk about his eldest son's incestuous relationship, when Reuben actually sleeps with one of his wives. But as a closing story about Jacob's life, let's talk about the favourite son, sting. Another sting. Jacob's a man of faith by this time. He's walking the walk of faith. But in Genesis 37, we read about Joseph. Jacob's favourite son. Jacob now makes the mistake that his father and mother made, of having favourites. Jacob's favourite was Esau, Rebekah's favourite was Jacob. Now Jacob has a favourite, Joseph. And Joseph has these dreams that you've heard about, and I'm sure, if nothing else, you know the story of Joseph and his amazing Technicolor dream coat. But what's interesting is his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Jacob did not dismiss the dreams of Joseph. And the story goes on, and what happens is that at an opportune moment, his brothers jump Joseph in the middle of the wilderness, and they drop him in a pit, and then they take his wonderful robe, and they dip it in blood, and they sell him as a slave off to Egypt, and they take the robe back to Jacob. And his father recognized it, it says in Genesis 37:33. He said, "It's my son's robe. A vicious animal has devoured him. Joseph has been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth around his waist, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters tried to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I will go down to Sheol to my son mourning." And his father wept for him. At this stage in his life, Israel makes the mistake of favoritism, and then because he has had an unnatural and unreasonable favoritism, he also enters into an unnatural and unreasonable grief. For the next 13 years, Joseph spent time rising from slave to prime minister. And for 13 years, Jacob did not get over this. His pilgrimage was a tough one. His favourite son was dead. Except, of course, the real irony of it was he was alive. And you know the story, how Jacob eventually went down in times of difficulty to Egypt and once again met his son, Joseph. Jacob was then able to talk to Pharaoh about the wonder of his pilgrimage. He got stung again. And again, I have to ask you, is this still a crop grown from the seed that he sowed? Or is this just the stuff of life? Because the truth is, these things happen. But here we have another generation that have risen up, his own children, who are actually behaving how he did when he was a child. And there are many things in life which are generational. Some of them we need to break them in the name of Jesus. Some of them are serious and can affect our pilgrimage. And we should not dismiss them out of hand. The truth is this, that Israel would have been better to have dealt with some generational issues in his family and prayed with his children about some issues before they actually took hold and manifested in the way that they did. But you see, Israel got his son back. And would it not have been better for Israel in his pilgrimage to have displayed the same controlled persistence in those 13 years as it was in the persistence he showed when he wrestled God? Yes, it would have been better. And when we stand before God, we will all see things that we could have done better. That's why it's important that we recognize that whereas we are a work in progress, we must now do the most we can to make the most of every opportunity. The Bible says, make the most of every opportunity because the days are evil. Interestingly enough, one of the last things that's recorded about Jacob, or Israel as he was then, is that when Joseph brings his two sons to Israel for a blessing, Israel offers out his hands to bless them, the right hand on the firstborn, and Joseph brings his sons in the correct order, so the oldest will be touched by Israel's right hand. And what does Israel do? Swaps his hands round, crosses them over. So in fact, Israel brings out in another generation the change in the priority of who gets the blessing. And he did that, and I can't help but think that that wasn't something to do with the experience he'd had himself. And of course, we have to watch out in our own pilgrimage that we don't... You know the thing that they say about people? People want to give children everything they didn't have when they were children. You know that? Well, we need to make sure that we don't act in the things of God in a way which is purely out of reaction to what we feel we missed out on. But what we need to do is act in faith. And I'm not saying Jacob or Israel were wrong in giving the blessing to Ephraim over Manasseh. Maybe that was a word he'd had from God. I'm not sure. But I can't help but think that it was a behavior linked to something he learned from his life. So, pilgrimage. Pilgrimage is fulfilled at the end of the Christ line in Jesus. And let me tell you two ways how pilgrimage is fulfilled in Jesus. Number one, Jesus said, "It is finished." What was finished? Jesus completed his pilgrimage. Jesus' walk on this earth was nomadic and transitory. He had a tent, and his tent was nailed to a cross, and he moved on. It is finished. Jesus completed a pilgrimage. And let me tell you, it was a hard pilgrimage. We can say, oh, life's tough, life sucks sometimes. But let me tell you, Jesus knew it all. Jesus knew it all, and he took it all on the chin. He completed his pilgrimage. Pilgrimage was fulfilled in Jesus when he said, "It is finished." And the second way pilgrimage is fulfilled in the Christ is this. Jesus said, surely, Matthew 28:20, "I am with you always to the very end of the age." It's a twofold pilgrimage that the Christ completed. He completed his own pilgrimage. But if we will walk with him, he will complete with us our pilgrimage. How wonderful. Not only was he prepared, God of gods, King of kings, Lord of lords, to come down on earth and walk a pilgrimage himself, he is prepared, having done all of that, to walk ours with us. How wonderful. Jacob wrestled with God for one evening. Jesus will walk for us for one lifetime. I think that's a pretty good deal and a marvellous pilgrimage. So in conclusion, Romans 8:28. Romans 8:28. Get it into your head. It's fabulous. It can revolutionise your life. We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. We have got God working things for our good. We don't have to grasp anyone's heel. We don't have to muck around. We don't have to manipulate and force it to happen. God is working for our good. And sometimes we have a spoonful of medicine that tastes horrible, but it works for our good. And some things in life stink to high heaven. Some of our experiences are unpleasant. They hurt. They hurt like hell. But God is working them round for our good. And if we can just live and walk in that faith and believe in it, our pilgrimage can be fabulous. And Jacob leans on his staff and says to Pharaoh, "The days of my pilgrimage have been there, you know, we've had a great time really." And look at it. Jacob's pilgrimage was great. And our pilgrimage can be just as great. There's a fabulous verse in Psalm 84, verse 5. It says this, "Blessed are those whose strength is in you, who have set their hearts on pilgrimage. As they pass through the valley of Baca," which means tears, "they make it a place of springs." In other words, when they pass through a valley of salt water, they make it into fresh. Tears of salt? Yeah. "They have set their hearts on pilgrimage." The word here, pilgrimage, literally means thoroughfares or raised public roads. Do you know the problem with walking on a raised public road? Everybody can see you. The Bible says, "Blessed are those who will walk out their lives on raised public roads." Blessed are you if you will walk where people can see you walking for Jesus. Blessed are you if you will live out your life in open acceptance of Jesus as Lord, because your tears, you'll have them, will taste like fresh water. because by faith you will experience Romans 8:28 every step of the way. And God will work out in your life for good. And even the tears will be fresh water to you. And the truth is this. Salt water poisons everything that's growing. Fresh water gives life. You might think, this is poisoning me. My circumstances are killing me. If you believe Romans 8:28, your pilgrimage will be evidenced by life coming forth out of the ground that has been watered by poison. The secret of our pilgrimage will be that if we can learn always to seek first the kingdom of God instead of grasping, God will busy himself about working good in our lives. And I know and have experienced the goodness of God in the land of the living, and I will experience much more yet. And I just want to encourage you to learn the lesson from Jacob tonight. Our pilgrimage is a process of polishing and preparation, of sifting and separation, of calling and glorification. But it's a process. It's not instant. We serve a now God, but we have a pilgrimage to walk. Jacob walked his. We must walk ours. But in the Christ, the fulfillment of this principle is that Jesus himself will walk with us on our pilgrimage. Amen.